forced not only economy of style, but an economy of perspective. Relating only what the reader needed to know in order to follow the story meant ignoring much of significance and making hard choices. In all cases, I have opted for narrative flow rather than interpretive complexity. My aim has been to make Charles an easy read, despite his being a complex man. During the time frame of this study, England used the Julian calendar, in which the year was reckoned to begin on the 25th of March. In this book, all dates are given new style, with the year beginning on the 1st of January. In an aristocratic society, men acquired titles and elevations of rank during their lifetime. I have taken the liberty of designating them by the title by which they are known historically, even if they hadn't yet received it by strict chronology. Finally, matters of money present challenges both historical and contemporaneous. Most statements of royal revenue and debt are approximations and are best used as comparisons rather than absolutes. For the curious, there are a number of calculators of the historical worth of money. In spending value, £100 in 1625 is equivalent to £16,000 in today's money. Finally, spelling and punctuation have been modernized in quotations from primary sources. Mark Kishlansky, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Prologue. Even his virtues were misinterpreted and scandalously reviled. His gentleness was miscalled defect of wisdom, his firmness, obstinacy, his regular devotion, popery, his decent worship, superstition, his opposing of schism, hatred of the power of godliness. Charles I is the most despised monarch in Britain's historical memory. Considering that among his predecessors were murderers, rapists, psychotics, and the mentally challenged, this is no small distinction. In most modern accounts, he is portrayed as a mean, petty, and vindictive tyrant who brought misery to his subjects and ruin to his nation. However, Charles did not earn these censures by having an aberrant personality. Indeed, his characteristics were mostly laudable. He had refined sensibilities and loved art, music, and dance as a connoisseur rather than as a dilettante. He was a religious man, at prayers daily, attentive to sermons, and he died a martyr to his church. Abstemious, he dined moderately and diluted his wine to keep a clear head. His court was in decorous contrast to the boisterous one he inherited. He himself was never obscene in his speech, or affected it in others. Moreover, Charles was an uxorious husband, the only 17th-century monarch who took neither mistresses nor lovers, and a doting father before his children were ripped from him by the disaster of civil war. He even aspired to make England a great European power. All of this should have weighed in his favour. Charles lived in an age that attributed historical catastrophes to the will and personality of individuals. In a monarchy, the king was the obvious prime mover. But many contemporaries found only modest faults in his character. The Earl of Clarendon, who knew the king better than most, believed that he was too soft, unwilling to slip the iron fist inside the velvet glove. The Archbishop of Canterbury's chaplain, Peter Heylin, who also observed the king firsthand, remembered a maxim of King Charles that it was better to be deceived than to distrust. This piety, Heylin regretted, proved a plain and easy way unto those calamities which afterwards were brought upon him. The king's inclination to bestow benefit of the doubt made him slow to react to challenges to his authority, which led inevitably to greater challenges. For this reason, Sir Philip Warwick, who attended the king in his last years, characterized him as a gracious and a serious prince, by diversity of counsels drawn off from his own judgment. If these were grievous faults, then grievously